Trek. I'm Jordan Dowler Coltman. I'm joined by Elliot Tanti and Braden Dowler Coltman. We've been off for a couple weeks, boys. We're back. Lots to cover as we get into it. Braden, I know that you're about to begin another contract, but you haven't been employed for the last week or so. So the question I have to ask you is this. Out of like a percentage of the day, how much time has been spent watching college basketball?
The first 2 days of the tournament, probably a good 6 hours. I don't know what that equals in percentage.
Well, how much time are you awake for in the day, I guess? Out of 24.
A few more hours than that. I was away for the weekend, but I have been keeping up. I mean, my bracket, as is everyone's, is busted, and thus is March Madness. It's been a good tournament so far. I'm sure we're going to talk about it, but there's been a lot of fun basketball. The women's side in particular has been a lot of fun to watch.
Elliot, same question. How much basketball have you consumed in the last 48, 72 hours?
Approximately like 2 hours. I think I was at a bar having a drink with a friend and some lunch, and I definitely watched some of the game there and was very engaged with it. So yeah, like more than I think most tournaments, but that's not a lot coming from me.
All right, let's get to it. Here's topic one. Okay, we're going to start with the Oilers. Again, we haven't met in a few weeks here, so
Woo! We
got to catch up on some things. 10 goals against in the last 48 hours. A blip, Braden, or an indication that there may be something not quite right at this point in time as the Oilers turn the corner towards the final stretch down towards the playoffs here?
Nah, but a blip. I think that getting spanked by the Leafs as early as they did, little fire under them. They played really well against Ottawa. I mean, they just lost it at the end because they let a chance go. And I don't think it's something that is fundamental or systemic that will be a problem for that team moving forward.
Elliot, I guess same question.
Well, I think this is hugely problematic, guys. I've been saying this for weeks now with this team. I'm less concerned around the number of goals that have occurred most recently, and more so their inability to beat the best teams in the league. I mean, this is supposed to be the Stanley Cup contender. This is one of the oldest teams in the league. They're supposed to be ready to go. And when push comes to shove in these regular season meetings with good teams, the Oilers continually end up second best. I didn't think it was a very strong showing against Montreal and Ottawa, which were two teams that they should handily beat. So I think there's lots of cause for concern here. I'm not going to pull any punches. Like, this is simply not good enough.
So where would you identify as the biggest points of concern, again, moving forward towards the playoffs here?
Elliot? I think it's their inability to play a complete game. I didn't watch the Ottawa game today. I know they decimated them in shots and likely should have been better.
Possession was it was almost like a complete one-sided game.
Yeah, and fair enough. And, you know, those games happen where you just get out goalied or you lose kind of bad luck. But, you know, that game against Toronto, it's been hyped all week in this city. Important game, big game, and they didn't show up. I think of the Avalanche game a few games back. You know, there are some concerns here around their ability to play a complete game against the best teams, I think, through and through. Maybe today they did, and hopefully that's a sign of things to come. But you can't we've said this about the Oilers team so many times in the last couple of years. You can't show up late. You can't give up early. You need to play a complete 60 minutes. And given the maturity that they've added to this team, I'm just expecting something far better than what we're getting right now.
So, I mean, I think I agree with you in principle, Elliot, because it certainly has been a trend, I guess is the right phrase for it, a trend this season for the Oilers to be a slow starting team. And obviously they have dominated teams in the third period more so than any other team in the league. However, I would make only this observation about the Toronto game. I felt like they actually came out of the gates really strong. They drew a penalty literally less than a minute into the first period because they had all the possession after winning the opening draw. They came down. They like the ice was completely tilted towards the Toronto end right there to begin with. And Connor drew a penalty and they went on a power play and they got stuffed. And then from that point on, it just felt like they just didn't get the bounces through the first and second period that then they eventually got in the third. But it was weird because it felt like, as you say, there was a lot of anticipation and hype leading into that game. I thought they actually looked like they had gotten up and were ready to go. But then when they got hit, you know, it's that old Mike Tyson line. It's like everybody's got a plan till they get punched in the face. It looked like the Oilers kind of got staggered a little bit by how quickly Toronto was able to get that first one after a great start that just didn't go their way. I think what I'm more concerned about, and I think Braden kind of touched on, you know, his feeling like it's just a blip. But for me, it's like, this is the first time. And so I guess what I'm saying is I agree with you, Braden. It's true. This is the first time I think since the beginning of February or something, the Oilers have lost two games in a row in regulation. So like they're not stringing together losses are here, but at the same time, I do agree with you too, Elliot. Like it's frustrating to watch a team not be able to get up and dominate way that they should be based on what our expectations for them are, and more importantly, compete against the good teams. They should have beaten Ottawa handily today with that much possession, Braden, and they don't. Totally. They end up in a 3-3 game in the third period. And yeah. For me, with that team, I think that's unacceptable. I think they had to, you have to capitalize on those opportunities. You have to score, or what the heck good is all of that possession and all of that control?
Totally. I mean, I want my team to win every single game. At the same time, having them lose a game against the Leafs is not a terrible thing for the team itself moving down the stretch, looking at the playoffs, looking at a seven game series against a difficult team. What does it feel like to lose against that kind of a team? See it on the ice. You can, every single time you see McDavid or Draisaitl get frustrated.
You know what it feels like to lose. Like, I think at this point, as Elliot said, this is one of the oldest teams now in the league on average age. This is a mature team that shouldn't need those kind of lessons to be learned anymore.
Haven't all played together, right? Like Henry.
But that's an excuse. I don't think that that's fair. I think that this team is expected to win on a nightly basis because they're good enough to win on a nightly basis. I think more importantly, you know, look big picture here. The question, I guess, is this: is any of this going to end up mattering in the long run? Are the Oilers really going to find themselves in a position to be trying to chase down Vancouver? Not right now, not realistically, I think. So looking at where you are, you're most likely going to line up against the Los Angeles Kings again. All that really matters at this point is staying ahead of them, clinching second, getting that home ice advantage for round one. And you know who your opponent's going to be. And frankly, I'm not sure catching Vancouver is what you'd want anyway, when you're dealing with the LTI Golden Knights, you know,
if they make the playoffs. I mean,
I think so. You asked me, and I didn't really answer your question on what's the concern, what's the big issue here, and is it a full 60 minutes? Yeah, I mean, that's like that's the cliche answer, and that's what everyone's been talking about. I think what's starting to creep into my mind, and the concern I have is, Henrik comes in, Carrick comes in, this is the team, right? And what I've found and what I'm struggling with is that, and again, I didn't see the game today, but what's that postseason lineup? And who's playing with who? And where's the consistency around that? And like, what are the four lines that are rolling over the boards in game one of the playoffs? And there doesn't seem to be the chemistry there yet. And they haven't figured out what those lines are. And I'm talking about like top six, even. Like, I don't know what our top six is right now. I don't know what are your top two lines. Like, I have an idea of what I'd like it to be and what I think it could be. And I think so does our coach, and so do most Oilers fans, but it doesn't seem to be working. And my concern here is,
what do you mean it's not working?
I think that there's a lack of consistency in the line up and down the lineup. I don't know what the third line is. I don't know what the second line is. I don't know what the
We know that Henrik's going to be the third line center. We know that either Fogler or McLeod are going to be on their wings. But like, those things have been
for sure. Do we for sure? Because there's also talk about Nuge being a very good third line center too. And do we want McDavid and Draisaitl together? Like, I don't know, and we can debate this the specifics of it to the end.
The most consistency,
but I just don't say. My concern right now is I don't see a cohesive sort of like strategic lineup that we're heading into game one of the playoffs with. And they have what, 15 games left to figure it out. That's what's alarming to me. That's the thing for me.
But do you want to be seeing those lineup changes happening beforehand, or do you want to see the consistency now? Because we have seen, for the most part this season, a top line of Nuge on the left wing, Connor and Hyman. And that has led Hyman to 50 goals this season. We've had a pretty consistent second line with Draisaitl at the helm. Anytime we run into a problem, we know Draisaitl is going to be brought up to the first line. Like, we've seen the consistency all year. Is this the time that you want to see them totally shuffle up and see, you know, like what the chemistry is? Or do we just work
every day in and day out?
Well, that's we're second in the Pacific. I would call that working.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a streaky year, Brayden. I like I said, this might be a lot. This is I'm drawing a lot of cause for concern very early. And I just see other teams that have made deals at the deadline that look like there's consistency through the lineup top to bottom. They know where they play. They know their roles. I'm not convinced yet that this team is there. Can they get there? Absolutely. There's tons of time left to figure that out. I still think people are working out their role on this team. And that is, you know, as an Oilers fan, that's what I'm worried about. And I think that we're seeing, when push comes to shove against good teams that can consistently throw out the same lines over and over and get good matchups, the Oilers aren't winning those games. And I think it's because we just do not have, people have not quite figured out their roles yet. Well, and I do think defensive pairings are a problem. Like, I don't see, there's inconsistency there too. Anyway, I've talked a lot about this, but
Okay. I think, Elliot, you make some very good points about like the consistency pieces. What you definitely want to see as you come down the stretch, you want to start to see your team kind of like round into form. They certainly were doing that last year leading into the playoffs. I think they were, after the Ekholm trade, they were something like 14-2 and something, but it was a fantastic push to the playoffs that kind of set you up feeling with some confidence and that you were going into the playoffs in the right way. I guess I would say that seems to be a little bit lacking right now. As you have acknowledged, this is a very streaky team, but equally there's just some very streaky members of this team. I guess the question from today's game, outside of the fact that like you can't blow a 3-1 lead, like at this point when you're that good, you should not be blowing a 3-1 lead. That tells you that you are fundamentally not sound defensively.
At the same time, you have an AHL goaltender who's going to let those things in. Like,
but
we
know
Pickard
hasn't played to that level. And also, Braden, Stuart Skinner is not an AHL goaltender. He let in 5 goals in the first period last night against Toronto. So we can't blame it on goaltending either. There is clearly some structural problems that are leading to some leaks in the boat. And the question is, can you figure out how to plug them or not? And then it comes down to some of those pieces and some of those players who I would argue are not currently pulling their weight. It was interesting. You have Vander Kane scratch today after a pretty obvious argument on the bench the night before with Leon Draisaitl. This isn't really our segment, but I'll ask Braden, is that something or nothing?
I mean, it's something and nothing. I think that it's natural. These guys want to compete and they want to compete at the best level that they can. And when they're down, you know, as badly as they were against a team like Toronto with everybody looking at them and watching them and expecting them, like we all just said, for them to come out on top, things are going to boil over. We know Leon has that nature in him. We know Evander Kane has that nature in him. So I'd call it not, yeah, I don't think that was necessarily cause for,
but what do you make of the healthy scratch?
Well, I mean, he hasn't been productive. He hasn't been pulling his weight. That guy's effectively an elite scorer, and he hasn't quite lived up to that at any of his time in Edmonton, a little bit last year in the playoffs, but we need him to come back to that form, or else, you know, like Elliot says, we're not going to be able to find anything that clicks, really, especially with him, you know, dropping further and further down the lineup.
So I obviously have been in a cone of silence. I didn't know that happened today, but I did see the argument in the Toronto game, and it was obviously very heated. I would have concern about that. And I think, you know, it's put up or shut up with these guys. And I think there's a lot of people feeling that. I mean, let's not go like too crazy here, but we've also got Leon moving into the final year of his contract, right? And Evander Kane is here. So like, there's other larger concerns that I would have, and that the consistency isn't working right now. Like, I don't know. I worry about this team. I do. I really do. And I a third showdown against LA, who hates us, who hates our team top to bottom, and does not want to get beat for a third time. If the Oilers need to be on par or like on the ball and need to be strong heading into that series, and any issues in the dressing room or whatever with consistency would cause a problem. Like that does worry me.
All right, Braden, I'll give you the final word.
Yeah, I still think it's but a blip. We talk about them being streaky. I know the biggest streak that they were on was that cold streak at the beginning of the season. They rarely lose back-to-back games. So in a best of seven, I'm still feeling pretty good about this team.
All right, that's topic one.
Hey, podcast listeners, my name is Larice Campbell, and along with my co-host, former Olympic bobsledder, Alicia Olson, I am so excited to introduce you to the Mother Pucker podcast. And if you love the Oilers like we do, you are going to love our show. It's just two gals who aren't afraid to drop the gloves and throw some hot takes about the boys in blue and orange. Whether you're a massive hockey fan like us or just looking for some new voices talking about the Oilers' blue line, or lack thereof, we promise the show is for you. So subscribe now and tell your friends. It's time for the Mother Pucker podcast.
All right, let's jump to topic two. Braden, you want to cue it up for me?
Tour d'horizon.
All right, so this is our Tour d'horizon segment where basically we just do a real quick rip around the sports world, a bunch of different stories, get these guys quick and unfiltered takes on each of these things. And of course, neither of them have been prepared for what we're going to talk about, so they have to just react on the fly. But I think they could probably have guessed where we were going to start, which is March Madness. Obviously, we are now well into both the men's and women's tournament. I want to start before I get into the actual sort of brackets, and we can talk about those in a second. But just in terms of the like attention and the scale of it, we've talked a lot on this show about the growth of women's sports in general, just the way that we feel like we're kind of in a golden age as far as the level of attention, the level of broadcast, the level of opportunity that seems to be there for professional women's sports, but equally obviously collegiate women's sports, which is, to be fair, I think always been more prevalent than professional women's sports for a long time. I mean, you look at the dominance of women's soccer in North America, and that is largely because of the growth of women's soccer at the collegiate level through the 80s and 90s. And so obviously the collegiate basketball part of it, the collegiate softball is very big in parts of North America. Collegiate women's sports has always been big in its pockets. Now it is getting its due, I think, in a better way. And part of that is it's got some stars, and Caitlin Clark obviously being the biggest among them. So I asked off the top how much basketball you'd watch, Braden. I guess maybe flip it in a different way. Like, how much of the basketball you've consumed, you know, includes women's basketball? And would that have been the case a few years ago?
About 50% of it has been watching the women's game. And like you said, there's people to follow. I think that's why people enjoy this tournament, is that there's, you know, you start to see, mainly in the men's side, you start to see a lot of the prospects that will end up making it to the NBA. We've got a remarkable league in the WNBA, which a lot of these players in the women's game will end up being elite superstars. But as you said, or as you asked about watching it before, like, not, definitely not. I mean, I don't even think it was as accessible on the channels that I watch March Madness on. So there's a shift there, and it's been great because the basketball has been awesome. And there's been some great storylines, a lot of Cinderella teams that continue to make it exciting. And no, I think it's been a really good tournament so far.
Elliot, how much do you think that the growth of this sport really, right now at least, sits on the shoulders of Caitlin Clark?
A massive piece right now, but just the latest star. And that's what's great about the women's game and it being prevalent and available, is that, you know, there's an opportunity for her to make her mark. And who's the next one and the next one after that? And the stories go on and on and on. To blend my two passions of sports and politics, I mean, this is the legacy of Title IX, right? And the notion of gender-based discrimination and its impact on collegiate sports. You know, now not only are we seeing a strong professional league exist, but people are getting excited about the pipeline to that professional league. And why does that pipeline exist? And because of Title IX and the commitment to equal opportunity for women in sports. It's faced lots of criticism over its years and changes, and you know, people have pushed back and forth on it. But this is the legacy that we have: women's game that's available to us, that's on TV, that people are interested in. It's Title IX and it's the TV contracts, but now we've got the pipeline and we can watch for that next star and be excited about her impact on the game, which is great.
The other thing I think that is beneficial that I think is a good thing here doesn't seem to happen all the time in other places is that because of the scheduling of this and the fact that both tournaments happen within each other's schedules, there's an opportunity here from a TV perspective for that channel flipping fan to not just be limited to the men's game and then 4 weeks later try to get another audience built for the women's game, which is often the case. I think it's a good lesson in terms of recognizing the benefit of those built-in eyeballs that are going to be there for a brand that, again, traditionally, historically, was male sport dominated, but now there's an opportunity for both of them to coexist and equally benefit, I think, each other. You know what I mean? It's a bit of I think in other circumstances it would be of detriment to it. Okay, so really quickly here, we didn't do a bracket thing or whatever. We're not that show, but let's just really quickly share our final four, and we'll go men's and women's tournaments. So let's start with the men's tournaments. Braden, who are your final? We'll worry about who's getting out of the final four into the finals in a second, but start with just your final four. Who do you have making it?
Yep. I got the number one seed, UConn Huskies, in the East with North Carolina in the West. So the 1-1. I'm already out on Kentucky because they got smacked in the second round. And then Purdue. I got Purdue because of that giant of a Canadian and Zach Edey.
Very nice. Elliot.
Yeah, I only did a men's bracket, but I got smoked by Kentucky as well too. So that whole kind of like Southern Conference for me is a disaster. But outside of that, I'm still alive. I've got Purdue as well. Same thing, Canadian connections. Thought it would be good. And then I've got Arizona and Iowa State on the other side. And, you know, I'm an Iowa boy through and through. So not really. I was there.
Hell, does that mean?
I've been there
for
once,
like a month.
Yeah.
What's their mascot?
I have no idea.
The Hawkeyes.
Anyway, I'm still alive, but what Yahoo Sports tells me is I am 230,000th out of the 559,000 people, so pretty mid bracket. Quite literally a mid bracket right now. I was up to 8,000th until Kentucky lost, though.
So. Yeah, that was a good one.
Okay, I have UConn, Arizona, Gonzaga, because I'm a homer and I've always loved Gonzaga, but I don't think they'll actually be Purdue. I just have them because it's where it is.
You never know.
Houston as well, which I got lucky on. So jumping forward.
Yeah, didn't they go to overtime today?
Yes. Did they win? I don't know if I saw that score.
No.
Let's jump forward then. Who do you have in the final and who do you have winning, Braden? And then we'll jump to the women's bracket.
Well, Houston did win, but I've got UConn winning.
UConn winning against who?
Against Purdue, the Boilermakers. Okay.
And Elliot.
Iowa State beating Kentucky. So Kentucky's already out, so they've basically won.
You're a winner, baby.
Fair enough. And I have UConn versus who do I have them versus?
Clearly you were invested in this.
Oh, Houston. I have Houston all the way.
Yeah. Okay.
I have UConn winning though. I'm never very good at that. I always take somebody too high and then I get beat, but I think UConn's got it in them.
That's how it goes.
Let's jump to the women's side of it. All mine are still alive. I don't know if you actually made a bracket or not, Braden, but if not, you know what, Elliot, you didn't. and shame on you for that. But pull up the women's bracket. Look at who's still alive, and you can do it now. You can do it now. I'll tell you mine right now. Obviously, yeah. I have Iowa because yeah. I am fully invested in Caitlin Clark. I have LSU, who's the defending champs.
Angel Reese. I mean, come on.
I have Oregon State, and I have South Carolina. So all still alive. Nice. I have South Carolina taking on Iowa in the final, and I have Iowa winning. Because again, I just think that that's the storybook finish. And also, like, this is the reality of it. She's going to have a great WNBA career, probably, hopefully, barring some problem, injury, whatever. But she should have a fantastic professional career. But this is kind of the zenith. Like, this could be that crowning moment of being like, this is the best female basketball player in the world right now, playing against her peers. And no matter what she does in the WNBA, if she wins this tournament, her legacy is already secure.
Braden, it's secured.
Who do you have?
As Kanye says, secured. I've got the Gamecocks, South Carolina, coming out of whatever division that is. I've got Stanford.
Okay.
And then I've got who was it here?
This is great. This is a great podcast.
Oh, Ohio State, but they're out. So
okay.
And then Iowa, obviously. It'll be Iowa versus LSU in that Elite Eight.
They're on the same side of the bracket.
They're on the same bracket, but that'll be the bracket.
That's really the title game.
That's the title game. Those are okay. the best of the best. I was really hoping Louisville would do well. Haley Van Lith is on that team, and she also will be exceptionally touted for the WNBA.
Elliot, you're muted.
Sorry, folks. I have Notre Dame coming out of Region 1. Big fan of Notre Dame. But they'll lose.
Rudy!
And then in the bottom bracket here, I'm feeling Texas, and I'm feeling Duke. Duke, Texas, and Notre Dame.
All right. Okay, let's keep moving here on our tour d'horizon. I'm getting better at pronouncing it, I think.
Right? Yeah, wait, did you just say three teams?
No, and Iowa, because he's from Iowa. Iowa.
Gotcha.
Iowa winning both the men's and the women's, which would be a hell of a story, but...
It would.
All right.
Completely because of me.
Has that ever happened?
The same school winning both? I don't know. Google it, Braden.
You can
tell us. Well, I don't have it ready to go. You think I'm a walking encyclopedia of NCAA basketball history?
Well, I thought this was the
tour d'horizon.
So I thought maybe you would.
Usually I just make things up on this show, as we all know. All right, let's talk about something I do not know a lot about, but I am very curious to get some actual thoughts and perspective on from two people who, at least on this show, pretend to really enjoy baseball. Shohei Ohtani and his translator. This has become like an international scandal. Which of you would like to volunteer to walk me through this, at least as far as you're able to understand it? Let me give you my like Cole's Notes layman understanding, and then you tell me if I'm right and help me walk through it. There is a situation that has occurred where his translator has basically stolen money from him, or defrauded him of money, or maybe helped launder money related to gambling debts, that now there are some questions around whether those gambling debts included betting on baseball.
Oh, boy, so, Elliot, we got the next Pete Rose.
Talk me through this one, Elliot.
Well, I mean, there's two ways that you can go about it. There's what's been publicly discussed and is out there.
What's the other way?
These are allegations. Okay. There are allegations. We need to say that as a media broadcasting corporation concerning Shohei Ohtani and his translator. Yes, essentially, Shohei's accountant showed up and found 4.3, 4.4, 4.5, the numbers don't really matter, around $4 million missing from his bank account. And it
is that how the accountant said it? The numbers don't really matter.
Well, really, when you're making $700 million, 4.3 is a flash in the pan.
Now, right. Interestingly, he's actually not making. Well, he's making.
Well, he yeah.
Given yes. that, but he makes yes. like,
his worth is. He's also making 65 in endorsements alone.
So the story goes that he stole the money. The translator stole the money from Shohei Ohtani to pay back gambling debts that may or may not have been involved baseball or not. The conspiracy or the concern around baseball is that these were actually Shohei Ohtani's gambling debts. And thus, that would be a problem because you can't bet on the sport that you're playing in. And, you know, $4.5 million in gambling debt would also be incredibly problematic as well, just as an individual. So,
especially when you're betting
a story like, here, those
you're
are the
Shohei and
I am
you're
not
losing
going,
money.
I'm not going to speculate on any of this. No one really knows except for the people involved, and it would be inappropriate for us to discuss. What we can talk about on this show is the impact of this scandal on the LA Dodgers, who have for a number of different reasons. Quadruple down on Shohei Ohtani as the, you know, marquee name in baseball, and the Dodgers are the Dodgers. And I think this is a very disappointing start to the relationship between the two teams. And until we know more, which I'm sure we will now, given the international scale of this scandal, and by the way, they just opened up their season against the Padres in Korea, so that has elevated the conversation in this. We just won't know, but this certainly can't be what the Dodgers were hoping for in terms of the first season of Shohei Ohtani in LA.
I think they're going to have to suspend him.
Actually.
So we get down to the bottom of this.
Do you think baseball will actually do that, though, Brady?
This
when
is
you say they should, and do you think they will?
Of course not. No, this is their main million-dollar man. He didn't gamble. The guy next to him did.
Right.
Shohei's going to speak tomorrow at a press conference to lay
will
out
the translator every... be there?
He's since been relieved. He's
So they found him another translator, one with less gambling debts.
Yeah, correct. So
oh,
we'll see
good.
What
was
Shohei
that question
has
number one on the interview? Do you enjoy gambling on baseball? Oh, I mean, perhaps we should actually check on this. Oh, dear. Indeed. All right. Well, I guess we'll wait and see now how this story continues to unfold. I had a whole bunch of more things for this. This show's already going long. Let's just wrap it up. Our tour d'horizon with one last. Thank you, Braden. With one last storyline. Anybody catch the Australian Grand Prix?
Yeah. And what amazing feats it is for any of the drivers on the grid to finish above Max Verstappen, Lewis Hamilton, and George Russell.
Well, here's the interesting thing. So obviously Carlos Sainz wins the Grand Prix. There's a couple storylines, and we'll talk more about this obviously on our other show, Pit Stop, which you can listen to right here on this network coming Tuesday. But while we've got Elliot here, who of course is our diehard Red Bull fan, tough day there for Max Verstappen, whose right rear brake didn't release as the lights went out, and he went around the track once with it caught, and then it caught fire and exploded, and he was forced to retire the car a lap in, and that opened the door obviously for some other teams to have a chance. And a fantastic drive by Carlos Sainz, who of course missed the last Grand Prix in Saudi Arabia because he had his appendix removed after it burst.
So he was lighter.
That's what I want to know, is how many drivers do you think now go get some cosmetic surgery done and have an organ removed?
I think Carlos said that in an interview after. Like,
well, the
I
question
all
I
these
have,
drivers need to get
no,
rid of
Lando
appendix.
Said it. Lando said he's going to go have his pulled. The question I really have is like, do you think the team had to add weight to the car to max, like to get back to his preseason level that they balance him off of all year? I mean, I don't know how much the appendix weighs really, but more importantly to this piece of it, Braden, can you, I guess just in terms of like how important do you think we talked, I think on the last show about sort of like the slide or slight like tapering off of the North American excitement around Formula One.
Okay. Yeah.
Do you think that this is a a net positive every time now that Max Verstappen has some issue and loses? Is it actually beneficial for Formula One?
Totally. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's great to see any athlete win multiple times. It just gets a little bit old in this sport because I couldn't tell you exactly why it gets old in this sport. We just, you want to see a little parity. You want to see it change a bit sometimes. And you know, I think because it's a point system, it's nice to see some of those teams that might not have a chance at every other race moving forward, you know, get a few extra points in a race like this one.
Okay, LA,
it would be even better if those teams or cars were able to actually compete with Max instead of just
here's what's
beat him by a DNF.
Max is in the same car as his teammate, right? Like Sergio should have, or pardon me, yeah, Sergio should have had a better night or a better day that he ended
but
up
he didn't,
having too.
He didn't start on pole.
No, that's true. And actually, here's an even weirder stat for you, and I will talk about this too with Tyler in a couple of days, but this is, for some reason, this is the one race where the top three on the grid have never finished as the top three in the history of Australia. So if you're one, two, and three, somebody in there isn't finishing the race, which is bizarre and strange and just an interesting statistic. Here's the other really weird one. Every single time that Carlos Sainz has won, George Russell has DNF'd. Just some weird, very weird
bizarre
stats. And again, I don't know if you watched it, Elliot, or not, but I also, I mean, it's not as dramatic as like the flu game for Jordan, but like watching Carlos Sainz very gingerly get out of that car at the end of it, considering how excited you knew he must actually be, demonstrated the physical toll his body was under having, you know, abdominal surgery less than 14 days ago. A pretty impressive feat nonetheless. But for you, give us your last defense there of Red Bull before we call this segment to a wrap.
No, I do think it's good. I think Braden's points were well made. I do think it's good that there's interesting things happening in F1 because there haven't been for a while, unless you get down into like the mid-table and you're really deeply passionate about it. It seems to be the only sport in the world that hasn't yet quite figured out that parity is actually a good thing for ratings. And so hopefully they do, or they figure it out. I mean, I still think Red Bull is the team to beat and will be for a while now. But it's nice that in his absence, Max Verstappen's absence, Ferrari, the sort of culture car, the culture company of F1, go 1-2. I think that's good. I think that's good for the sport, and it's good. And who knows? Maybe this opens things up to make things more interesting than any of us had predicted going into the season.
If anything, this was a huge win for Ferrari. Like, it's one thing that Red Bull lost a car in the race, but having both the Mercedes cars out is huge for Ferrari.
All right, that's topic two. Hey, if you're a fan of Formula One, then I've got the perfect podcast for you. The Pit Stop Podcast, presented by the Ordinary Podcasting Network. After every single race of the Formula One schedule, Jordan and Tyler will break it down, give you some news, analysis, insight, before answering your questions and setting you up for the next race. That's the Pit Stop Podcast, available everywhere you get your podcasts. We're going to take our hats off here, wrap this little show up for the evening. I will go first because if I don't go first, someone
we're
is
doing
going
hats
to,
off.
Someone is going to take mine. So I'm going first. I'm taking my hat off to the 50 goal man, Zachary Hyman, one of the best contracts in the history of the NHL. And I only say that because Leafs Nation for the last 3 years has tried so hard to convince themselves and then everybody else that they were better off without Zach Hyman, that they had got away from a bad deal. And there's absolutely no way they can make that argument. Zachary Hyman has been exactly as advertised. He is arguably the best free agent signing the Oilers have had in a decade. I can't think of a better one from that perspective. There's been some good trades. I mean, the Mattias Ekholm trade's a very good trade for the Oilers as a net positive, but Zachary Hyman is the best asset they have acquired as a free agent in a very, very long time. He has as I said, exactly as advertised. He is one part Ryan Smith in front of the net. He is one part, you know, the agitator who's able to go and bulldog the puck, and he makes plays out of nothing. Sometimes he's an energy kind of guy, goes to the difficult places, and he clearly is a positive voice in that locker room. You very rarely see an angry or an agitated, like upset Zachary Hyman. He seems to love every second of his profession. And I think that that rubs off on some of the guys on his team. I think that's beneficial in your leadership group, you know, to have that kind of guy. And as I recall, when we played in the bubble and we're only playing the Canadian teams, we played Toronto more than we've ever played them in a single season. He drove us nuts. So to have him on your side is a benefit. So I take my hat off to Zach Hyman, and equally I take my hat off to you, Toronto fans. You got to give it a rest. He scored 50 goals. There's absolutely nothing you can say bad about this contract anymore. Elliot, you're up.
Golf is back, baby. And I don't know if any of you spent time watching the Players last weekend, but I did. And my goodness, was it an awesome start to the major season and to the golf season in general. Scottie Scheffler, of course, winning the first time ever back-to-back Players Championships. He's, you know, playing insane right now, minus eight on his final round. But it was, you know, that Island Green at 17, a TPC Sawgrass. Like, there's so much about golf that is so cool and so interesting. And when you watch these guys in the back nine of the fourth round of a major, just trying to grit it out, you know, honorable mention to Clark, who finished second, missed just a heartbreak birdie attempt. Anyway, it was a great tournament, and it's really exciting, I think, for golf that there are, on any given weekend, there are a number of players that can play themselves into contention, and the game just looks so beautiful on TV. I just loved it. Anyway, my hat's off, not to the PGA or to golf, but to Scottie Scheffler for back-to-back wins at the Players.
All right, Braden, bring it home.
I'm tipping my hat off to an athlete who had to deal with something rather difficult, and I'm tipping my hat off to him because of the grace in which he handled the situation. We didn't talk about this in the last segment, but in the race in Australia, there was a situation with a car, Williams, that was unable to drive, so Logan Sargeant was removed from the vehicle, and Alex Albon drove the vehicle for Williams. This is a really ridiculous situation that I don't think you really see in any other sports, like maybe in playoff situations, I guess, but just the situation where you have to be removed completely from the race to allow a more seasoned driver, you know, a chance to capture some better points. My hat goes off to Logan Sargeant, because I think that would have been remarkably difficult. 23-year-old kid, he wants to compete, he wants to be out there. Obviously Williams isn't competing for top spots, but they are competing for points. Just a really tough situation all around, and I think that he could have easily thrown a fit about it, and perhaps he did. I never saw it or heard about it. So my hat goes off to Logan Sargeant.
Yeah, that's a good one. Unfortunately for Williams, Albon finished 11th, just out of
Well, they were close.
They were very close. And I think that was the gamble that they had to take. They only had
available
chassis. They did not have a spare chassis, as every other team did. That's part of the restructuring of an organization that's in some pretty bad financial situation. But yeah, weird situation. Very rare do we see it. But it is interesting when the driver who puts his car in the wall is the one that you end up, you know, benefiting. It's an interesting conversation, and I'm sure it's one we will have on the Pit Stop podcast. Braden, Elliot, thank you both. Braden's got one more thing.
Yeah, in 2004, the University of Connecticut became the second school ever and the first in Division I to win the men's NCAA national championship and the women's basketball title in the same season, and then did it again in 2014. So this is the 20-year anniversary and the 10-year anniversary. UConn will likely have a very good chance of being in the Final Four. Unfortunately, their women's team, I think, is already out, but there you go.
There you go.
Hawkeyes, baby.
You didn't even know their name earlier, Elliot.
And now he does, as he does the Padres.
All right.
The unofficial, official podcast of the Iowa Hawkeyes.
The bandwagon's always open. All right. Thanks, Elliot. Thanks, Braden. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Again, if you haven't already, hit subscribe, tell a friend, send it to your mom. You know, I think she'd really enjoy it. Until next week, that was Hattrick.
Hattrick is a member of the Ordinary Podcasting Network. It's produced every week by Jordan Dyler Coltman and Braden Dyler Coltman. And follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Thanks for listening.
For those listening at home, Elliot has now gotten out of his chair and walked to the window. Braden also has made his way to the window. They both seem to be looking down to the street to see what the commotion could be caused by. Let us return to our regular scheduled program.
The Ordinary Podcasting Network wishes to acknowledge that the lands on which our conversations take place include Treaty 6 territory, the traditional meeting ground and home for many Indigenous peoples, including the Cree, Dene, Soto, Blackfoot, Métis, and the Nakota Sioux peoples, as well as the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples, including the territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh nations.
We acknowledge the many First Nations, Métis, and Inuit whose footsteps have marked these lands for generations. And we extend our appreciation for the opportunity to live, create, and share stories on these territories.
The Ordinary Podcasting Network intends to engage in conversations and dialogue, which acknowledge that reconciliation is not a destination, but a journey, and that we remain committed to practicing our craft in a decolonized space.